Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s. Tonight, we are pleased to host three soldiers who have fought in Iraq, Army Sergeant Camille Evans, National Guard Sergeant and resident of the Traumatic Brain Injury Center in Palo Alto, Brett Miller, and Army Specialist Colby Buzzell. Sergeant Brett Miller, was an Oregon National Guard Sergeant, was severely injured by a roadside bomb, commonly referred to as IEDs, on August 11th of 05 while riding in a Humvee in Iraq. He's currently being treated for traumatic brain injury, as I mentioned before, at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Palo Alto. Army Sergeant Camille Evans, middle, was trained as an intelligence analyst during her individual advanced training. For her service in Iraq, she was awarded the Army Commendation Medal. The far end is Colby Buzzell. He's an author, blogger, and former soldier with the United States Army. In Iraq, Colby began publishing a blog under the title CBFTW. As an anonymous soldier blogger, Buzzell was able to share more lucid experiences than the embedded journalists who were there. He published his book called My War, Killing Time in Iraq, combining narrative, blog entries, and emails. Please welcome our panel. I'll start with Colby. Same question, I guess, we'll start with all three of you. Well, the topic tonight is soldiers' stories. I think what we're interested in at this point is some of your impressions of Iraq, what you did in Iraq, and the kind of work that you did, your impressions of the place. So I guess question I would ask is explain a little bit about how you came to be there. In other words, why did you join the Army to begin with? What took you to Iraq in terms of like the unit, the work that you were doing, and maybe you could run through the experience that you had there, what was good about it, what was bad about it, your general impressions of the country and the conflict.
Oh man, where do I even start? Well, I lived in San Francisco prior to enlisting in the Army. I lived in the Richmond District over in 20th and Fulton. And I used to do temp work right here in the Market Street Financial District, temp work. And then I used to valet park in the North Beach district, at the Italian restaurants. And I would valet park on Friday and Saturday night. And I didn't find that lifestyle fulfilling, so I decided to join the Army. It was a year after September 11th, and I heard they were hiring, so I decided to join, and from there I got sent to Fort Benning, where I did my basic training, and then from there I got sent to Fort Lewis, Washington, and was part of the Striker Brigade combat team, and at the time they were non-deployable, but as soon as I got there, they changed that, and shortly after, I think 6 months afterwards, I got sent to Kuwait and then Iraq, and we drove into Iraq, and our first stop was the Sunni Triangle, and we spent a couple months there, and then from there we went to Mosul, and that's pretty much where I spent a majority of my deployment, was in Mosul, and I don't know. I mean, it was absolutely nothing like I expected it to be, but at the same, it's hard to describe, like... It was an experience. It was that, I don't know.
What was your most vivid experience? What stands out in that entire time you were there? Something that was either when you talked.
The first thing that came to mind was just the same streets over and over again. Every day the same patrol, the same streets, the same scenery, the same people. It was just living every day the same over and over again. That was the first thing that came to mind.
Were there any particular experiences that you had with the Iraqi citizens, with insurgents?
Yeah, there was a lot, but I don't even know where to start. There was a lot of experiences. I mean, there was the raids. There was the counter-mortar missions where we'd go sit up somewhere for hours and hours and just wait. I don't even know where to start with that one.
Okay. We'll get more detailed as we go along. Sergeant Evans is with a program that the military has called, it's called Why We Serve, and it can be seen at whyweserve.com. I guess I think that's it's a great question. Like, so can you tell, I mean, I think a lot of people don't really understand that very well. Why do you serve?
Well, actually, I was born in Houston, Texas, and then at the age of 7, me and my family moved over to Saudi Arabia, and that's where I grew up. And then from there, we moved to Thailand, and finally moved back to Houston again once I was in high school. And growing up overseas and seeing the way that their culture worked over there, most of the students only go to school up until 9th grade in Saudi, and after 9th grade, they go and get regular jobs and go to work. And I always knew, well, hey, I'm lucky I have this opportunity to, you know, grow up in a great country. And so I always wanted to give back to my community in some way. And right after 9/11 happened, I turned 17 right after that and went straight up to the recruiting office and joined. And then from there, I went to basic training in May of 2003, right after graduation, just a couple days. And then waited around at Fort Campbell for about a year and a half before we finally deployed. They kept telling us, okay, it's going to be March 06. You're going to deploy March 06. And then October 1st comes around. You got 10 days. We're deploying in 10 days. So get ready and go. We went to Kuwait on October 14th. And when we got to Kuwait, they're like, okay, we got here a little early. So you're going to spend another month here before we head over to Iraq. About 3 days later, all right, we're heading out tomorrow. So I went over to Iraq. I didn't have any sappy plates or anything. We were very unwell prepared. I didn't get my sappy plates until I got up to our base in Balad, and we spent about a year there, and the only thing that really stuck out in my mind is we did our guard duty. Every time we had our guard duty around the base, one of our ROEs is we weren't allowed to, if we were getting fired at, we weren't allowed to fire back at them until we radioed in to the headquarters and asked permission to. And that never seemed to bother us until the one day we were actually getting shot at, and the tower next to mine calls in and says, okay, we're getting shot at, can we fire back now? No, you can't. We can't confirm who's out there. It could be friendly units and whatnot. About 30 seconds later, the guy calls back on the radio. He's like, okay, well, my buddy just got shot in the head. Can I fire back now? No, just give him buddy aid. And the guy's like, well, did you not hear me? He's shot in the head. He's, you know, there's no buddy aid to be given. And we sat there for about 5 minutes taking fire before the fire ceased, and it just kind of dawned on us then that, you know, here I am, I was 20 years old, and then my buddy was 18. He had just gotten over there a couple weeks earlier, and, you know, and there's these guys that are sitting back in an office somewhere telling us what we can and can't do. They have no idea what we're seeing up front, so that was just my main experience that stuck out.
Sergeant Miller was pretty severely wounded by a roadside bomb, and we were talking in the back, and he mentioned that, in fact, he'd been hit by seven. I think you said seven roadside bombs in all?
Probably about nine.
Nine, even better. Can you describe a little bit what goes on? You know, that's really the I think, you know, 90%, 80%, 90% of all wounds, I think, are done by the roadside bombs. Describe for the audience a little bit about how they're made, what they do in terms of the mechanics of that, and then if you would you know, bring us up to the time that you got severely injured. What were the circumstances and what happened to you?
Well, to answer your first question, I was born in Sacramento, raised in Lake Tahoe, had a pretty much lived in California until I got married and moved to Oregon. That's where I was married, and I'd been a career wildland firefighter 13 years. I was teaching at a college level, wildland fire science and meteorology, and joined the National Guard to finish my master's and complete my education level so I could move up to more of a university level. And went for close to 6 years and then got deployed. We spent probably about 8 months in train-up in the States and then Kuwait. And my brigade was actually the brigade in Kuwait when Rumsfeld came and had a town hall meeting, and one of our soldiers spoke up about no armor on the vehicles, and that created a pretty big tailstorm. We had some new vehicles, but not all of them were new. We had canvas doors. We had to drive from Kuwait all the way to northern Iraq, where we were in between Kirkuk and Mosul. Our situation as far as ROE, like Sergeant Evans said, rules of engagement, was a little bit different. Our commander basically said, if someone shoots at you, you shoot back. No questions asked. And he said, we'll be behind you 100%. So we took that to heart the whole way up there. Perfectly honest, when I was rolling up, I didn't have any armor on my vehicle. And in order for us to put armor on the vehicles, you had to take out the glass windows and put steel on and this sort of thing in order to fabricate. And I decided not to do that because it was December and it was very cold, and I valued heat rather than armor. So I was warm driving up the whole way. Once we got to our area of operation, we started to settle in and kind of know the whole routine of the same streets, same people, same places. You started to get a feel for the area, you know, if something wasn't right. But the people who went outside the wire, the soldiers that were on the road all the time, the longer and the more days you were on the road, the more of a chance you had of getting hit. And I'd say that it was more of like a who knows if it's going to happen type of attitude. You kind of get this kind of like a God complex, if you will. You know, I'm invincible. Let's move. Just get out there and do it. And then when the first IED goes off, whether it hits your vehicle or not in that convoy, in that element, or, you know, group of Humvees, whatever mission you're doing, it's kind of a reality check that you have to look at. The IED that injured me, the one that was sufficient enough, was went off 6 feet off my door. Buried on the roadside. We were doing about 65 miles an hour in a Humvee. I was the truck commander sitting on the passenger side, had a full crew of five in the Humvee plus the gunner. The gunner was sitting down low, and when that IED went off, it was just a flash. A whole lot of gravel, dirt, asphalt, all kinds of debris. It shatters the mirrors, the glass, the ballistic glass on the Humvee was kind of all messed up. And at that point, I remember a sharp pain in my ear, and that was it. I didn't remember too much out of that. And as a result, that was in August of 2005. I've been an inpatient since then. In various hospitals between Balad, Iraq, which is the theater hospital, Landstuhl, Germany, Walter Reed, Madigan in Fort Lewis, and finally the Palo Alto VA, where I'm at now currently, still an inpatient. Results of my injuries, blind in my right eye, hearing loss in my right ear. I have left side weakness on my body due to the right side head injury. A huge chunk of my memory is gone, literally. My speech when I first got here was unbelievably slow and sporadic, if that. So a handful of injuries that I'm still sorting out.
Sergeant Evans, I was curious, how would you portray, or how would you say the general attitude of troops, maybe not, you might not be able to speak about exactly today, but generally speaking, what's the attitude of troops who are serving in Iraq today in terms of their mission and what they're doing there? I mean, we hear a lot of stories about morale being low or people, you know, starting to question more what's going on over there. In your experience, how would you describe the both the morale and the motivation level of the people who are now serving?
Well, while we were there, most of our unit, we were just kind of, it was our mission, that's all we were really concerned about. So, like, we weren't too into the big war picture. We only, I guess, were into our mission that we had to do every single day. And our morale stayed up mainly because of, like, letters we got from loved ones and people writing us, telling us they supported us while we were there, because that's really all we cared about, was making sure that people back home still supported us. So as long as we got those letters, and most of the time our morale was high.
Do you think, though, that, I mean, was there discussion much? Did people talk about, why they were there, or whether they agreed with what was going on? I don't mean to ask necessarily the political question in terms of agreeing with the president, but was there an overall sense yes, you know, this is what we need to be doing, or was it just, as you mentioned, just specifically like, I am a soldier, this is my job, and I will do my job?
Yeah, actually, it was all half and half. Half the people you talk to, they were really, you know, this is why I'm here, I'm ready to do it. But most of the time, people I came across, it was kind of, you know, this is my job, I signed up to do this, and that's why I'm here.
Colby, what's been your experience upon returning from Iraq? Do you think that the American public has a different feeling today about returning veterans? What's your overall sense of the how people view Iraqi war veterans?
Well, I think personally, I think there's a stereotype. I think from what I've experienced, automatically people think that you come back and you're all, you know, people have this image in their head of from the Vietnam movies, you know, born on the 4th of July, and like the guy that comes back and that's an alcoholic or can't function in society, that's all, you know, and he's totally screwed up. And I think some people kind of view our veterans, like coming back from here, like they should have problems, you know, like, you know, I've come back and I felt fine, but so many times, you know, I got people asking me, you know, all these questions, and it's kind of like, you know, I think they think I should be messed up, and they're shocked when I tell them I feel fine. But then again, I went to the VA hospital, you know, I had my parents and friends tell me, you know, go down to the VA hospital, get checked out, and I went down to the VA hospital, and that was kind of a nightmare. Not a nightmare, just all the waiting and all the... it was just a hassle, but I finally saw a doctor there and took the test, and, like, you know, they ask you the four questions, and if you answer yes to three out of four, you screen positive for PTSD. I answered yes to all four, and, you know, they're supposed to call you back, and they never did. Well, they did a month later, but by then, I lost all interest in going down there and dealing with all that. But, you know, there's a lot of people trying to get help at the VA, and my impression of it is it's very understaffed and a little disorganized, at least the VA in Los Angeles from my experience there. But, yeah, the transition back home has been different. You know, you come back and it's not like other wars where you get a parade or get spit on. Here it's you're invisible, you know, and that, I think that's what messes with the veterans' heads a lot more than the war, is you come back and you're released in a society into a world that really doesn't really care about what you or your other friends in your platoon did over there, you know, just out in the open as life goes on. And I think over time that wears on you. And I think that's the most difficult part of transitioning back.
Brett, there's been a lot in the news lately about conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I know that actually you were in a story in the Chronicle recently about your experiences with Army medicine and what you've dealt with the Veterans Administration. Can you address that at all? What's been your personal experience in terms of how you've been treated, dealt with in terms of as a wounded veteran, wounded soldier? Not only, I mean, obviously the surgeries, the treatments you receive, but just I think the bigger issue, as we all understand it, is really more the outpatient care and whether people, you know, focus on treating you all. What's your experience with that?
Well, when I was at Walter Reed, I was in a bed the whole time, so pretty much all I saw was ceiling tiles, and there wasn't really a lot for me to really comprehend then. I was still kind of shady, if you will. But I can see how the Walter Reed events that have transpired in the last month, how that can upset a lot of not only veterans but family members, just for the fact that, you know, if soldiers are being sent overseas and they pay a price, if not the ultimate price, but if they end up wounded and come back and then get treated, you know, less than, you know, a homeless shelter, I would see how that would really infuriate a lot of people. And as far as the Army's medical system, there's a lot of people that go through that medical system, a lot of soldiers. I had the opportunity to meet Bob Woodward, and I met him before and after his injury. And most people know Bob Woodward because of how high profile of a person he is. And everyone has seen Bob Woodward's recovery from injury to post-recovery, where he's at now. See him on news. But you got to keep in mind that over the last couple years, every time you'd seen a story about Bob Woodward, there's been 25,000, 40,000 other veterans that have been in the same exact shoes. A lot of people going through the system. And eventually there's going to be people who fall through the cracks. Where I'm at now, the Palo Alto VA specifically, the polytrauma unit, I don't think if I had unlimited resources and funding, I don't think I could find a better place to be. As soon as I came in the door, I was expecting, you know, just another random medical facility, but I was hit with a barrage of neural psychological exams and physicals and physical therapy, and you know, all it was overwhelming. I was exhausted, and then the PTSD clinic has you know, picked up. I mean, it's overwhelming. It really is, the amount of care that they have taken on down there. And just to touch on what Colby said earlier, a good friend of mine told me once that he said the greatest soldiers make the worst civilians. And it kind of rings true. You know, you have a lot of guys that go out there and give their 150, 160% for their country. And then when they come back, if they don't have, you know, the care or the provisions that they expected of the country that they fought for, it's going to be pretty difficult for not only them to fit back in, but their families.
Sergeant Evans, another item in the news, Army Lieutenant Watata is being court-martialed at this point for missing a movement, for basically refusing to go to Iraq. I'm curious, what do you, generally the troops, is there a, and again, I don't want you to speak on behalf of, you know, all soldiers everywhere, but in your experience, is there support for the lieutenant? I mean, do people support what he did or oppose what he did? There's been a suggestion that the war, unpopular as it is, would be over if a lot more soldiers just decided that, you know, they don't agree with the politics of the situation or the reason we went to war to begin with, and therefore if they refuse to fight, the war would be over today. What are your impressions about that?
Well, my standpoint is when we signed up or joined the military, we all signed an oath saying that we would follow the orders of the officers and those appointed above us, and when we're given that order, that's our duty to follow it. My personal opinion and some of the people I worked with, when we were in Iraq, when we heard about what the lieutenant did, and it's just kind of, you know, you knew what you were doing when you signed up for this. You knew there was the possibility of you going to war. If you didn't want to go, you shouldn't have joined in the first place.
Ditto.
Colby, what do you think about that?
I disagree. I'm not really too familiar with the situation, but you know, I understand a little bit of where he's coming from, and if he doesn't want to go, yeah, well, I do understand. You know, he signed the paper and all that stuff, but there's a part of me that does kind of understand his way of thinking. I just hope it's not for political reasons, and that's his, I don't know. If I was in Iraq and there was somebody there that didn't want to be there, that puts me in a dangerous situation. I'd rather be there with a bunch of guys that wanted to be there. And if he didn't want to be there, then, you know, let him face the consequences for that. But having a guy that really doesn't want to be there puts other soldiers in danger. And I don't know, that's kind of the way I look at it.
Britt, in the time that that you were in Iraq before your injury, what did you see anything that was good? I mean, were there situations that you looked at and you said, this is, you know, something useful is coming out of all this? I don't know what it might be, school, security, something. We hear about this a lot. I mean, there's this constant dialogue, I think, in the press of, like, you know, the whole, you know, good news, bad news kinds of thing. You know, we hear about the car bombings, horrific as they are. Did you see things, experience things where you said, you know, that's good?
You know, that's a great question. I had the opportunity when I was over there to be in history during their first election. We were in support of that. And we would delegate places with the locals in Iraq to find an area for the elections to where we can hold the actual voting and the ballot counts. And we incorporated in the Iraqi police and the Iraqi National Guard as kind of a multinational force. And when we would go and surround, it was two-part. We would usually find schools and secure these schools, set up road barriers around the schools to prevent vehicle-borne IEDs, that sort of thing, set up barriers. And when you can see the public coming out, seeing what you're doing, protecting a place that their children are at every day, you can see the gratitude if they don't come up to you and give you objects, whatever it is, or hugs, which happened quite a bit. Just little things that happen on a daily basis, like soccer is big in Iraq, and we used to get I requested a big box of soccer balls from home, and we would go out to the soccer fields and, you know, give these kids soccer balls, and next thing you know, the kids would be giving us intel on, you know, hey, this guy down there or this guy here, you know, there's a common thread over there, and it basically takes a hand of trust to earn it back. So saw it quite a bit every day, and it definitely outweighed the rocks being thrown at your vehicle and you know, you can definitely tell where anti-American cities are or anti-American areas.
Sergeant Evans, you work in intelligence for an aviation unit. I assume that gives you, you're probably privy to a lot of information about the insurgency, about certainly within the area of your operations. I think it's tough for most of us when we get our information from news sources, which are, I mean, it's a limited view oftentimes, and we don't know what you know. Without, you know, giving away any confidential, top secret kind of information, is it better or worse than we think it is? Is it better or worse than we see portrayed in the media?
Actually, for most of our intel, we did use CNN to get a lot of our intel. And
so did I.
The reason behind that was that they did have the most up-to-date information. They you know, most of the time it's portrayed the same. I think it's the same things going on there that they say. They just kind of had a more biased view on the whole situation. They showed mainly the stuff that we were doing wrong. And when, you know, that's what we wanted to know, though, is we wanted to know where all the enemy was and stuff like that. But what they're not showing was what we were actually doing. Part of our unit went up to Mosul and built a whole university, and they never showed any news coverage on stuff like that. When we built the hospital in Balad, it's one of the most state-of-the-art hospitals there. They didn't show any coverage on that, and that's where I think the news media gets wrong. They do have the stuff that's going wrong, they have that right, but the stuff that we're doing right over there, they have no coverage of that.
Colby, I would imagine that in the time that you've been back from Iraq, you probably keep in touch with a lot of the people that you served with, or certainly like a lot of people, obviously, you know, watch the news and what's going on. You were there in 2003 and 2004. What's your impression of how the situation there has changed since you were there?
Well, I don't really know since I'm not there, but my old unit is there, and I'm not going to, you know, mention his name, but, you know, I mean, well, you know, I still keep in touch with a lot of guys. They tell me it's a lot different than when I was there. It's well, they're in a different part of Iraq. I believe my old unit is in Baghdad right now, and they're providing theater-wide QRF, I think. I'm not sure on that, but they tell me it's, from the people that I've spoken to, it's way dangerous now than it was back then, and they don't see it getting any better. And, you know, it's weird because, like, you know, I talk to my friends on the phone. They call me up, and it's like they straight up tell me they don't think they're going to make it back this time. You know, it's their second deployment over there, and, you know, they call me, and they don't go into specifics, but they just get really scared, and they're, I've got a bad feeling about this, you know, I don't know, you know, it's different here, and they won't tell me exactly, what, you know, because operational security, but from what little contact that I have with the soldiers over there, it seems like it's getting worse over there.
Brent, do you think does the Defense Department do enough for its soldiers? I mean, you talked before about not having any armor on your Humvees long after. I think that was pretty much long after IEDs started popping up. And Sergeant Evans, you mentioned that, you know, you had to go into to Iraq without your for those of you who don't know, sappy plates are the heavier armor that you put on your body armor to protect from rifle bullets and that sort of thing. Is enough being done? Has enough ever been done? I mean, I know that obviously there are budgetary constraints and nobody ever seems to have enough money for that. But in a time of war, one would imagine that the government would do more and pay more and spend more and make sure that everybody not only is protected but even after the fact is treated as well as can be. And I guess I'd ask you this of all three of you individually: do we do enough? And if not, what should be done?
I think with anything, if you dive into something head first, there's going to be a lot of changes that you have to make, and you have to be kind of fluid When the conflict first started, there was a lot of things that changed that was out of our control, meaning Army. You know, insurgents, the enemy changes their tactic on a daily basis, and in order to keep up with that change is pretty big, monetarily and physically. As far as the armor, it was that was something that was brought into the limelight by a simple Joe, you know, someone's kid. And as a result, you know, the vehicle started to get beefed up. And I think through that mentality, it started, there was a lot more people that are willing to stand up and say, I think we need to improve this, or I think we need to improve that. By the end of my tour in Iraq, we had very fortified Humvees. We had anti-IED equipment on our vehicles. We had, weapon systems that were integrated. You know, we had a lot more things that kept the soldier himself out of harm's way. As far as that goes, when boots hit the ground, that thing, that scene is very adaptive. However, once that soldier comes back through my eyes, I have seen that the amount of energy that's focused towards troops and family members of fallen soldiers is could definitely be improved a lot on the Army side. Not just, and I don't mean just healthcare, but the amount of provisions that the government could put forth for those troops that, you know, really have nothing to look forward to once they come back. You know, I'm blessed to have all my limbs, but I know several soldiers that are very good friends of mine that don't have limbs, and it's almost as if it's just a simple check that's written off. Here's some money for your troubles.
We're going to be heading into the question and answer portion of tonight's program in just a few minutes, so you could please start lining up at the microphones if you have questions for the panel. I'm sorry, Camille?
What you were saying about, do we think we were well-equipped? Once we got up to Balad and got where we were supposed to be, and we were had more than enough stuff, and we had all the equipment we needed, I think the problem with us was is we were kind of like a last-minute push to go over there. We were told, you know, a couple weeks in advance we were heading over there instead of some, you know, a lot of more of the units were getting up to like 6 months out before they were ready. But by the time we got over there, we had everything we needed. I think it depends on like an individual unit-to-unit basis whether or not they had all their equipment. We didn't have any Humvees because we're all helicopters, so I'm not sure about the whole armored on the Humvees thing. But with our sappy plates, there was about a third of our unit that didn't have the sappy plates, and we were pretty much trading out when we got up there with the unit that we were taking over for. I think the only other, you know, most of the money issues for equipment, we probably, you know, of course we need more money. They need more equipment over there. They could always use more stuff to make it better. So that's always going to be the answer, I think, is yes, we could use the more equipment.
Colby?
I was real lucky. I was with the Striker Brigade, and we had everything that we needed, brand new, everything. I mean, I don't think I went over there with a single item that was used. Everything was brand new, even pretty much our vehicles. So I really have no complaints when it comes to equipment. What our government and military can do for veterans coming back, a lot more, I think. You know, I mean, I don't think a lot of veterans or people that are prior service are really too surprised about the recent Walter Reed scandal.
I don't know. Last question before we'll take questions from the audience. And again, I'll direct this to each of you individually, but I guess we'll start with Colby this time. ultimately, we're told this is about the Iraqi people and helping them, helping them escape tyranny of Saddam Hussein, helping them reestablish a country, a democracy. Your time in Iraq, did you form opinions about the Iraqi people themselves? Did you get a sense of who they are, what they are, whether this mission is valid from that standpoint?
No, there was a language barrier, and you know, being in the infantry, you go out and you're doing missions, and there's no interaction with them really. I mean, there's a little bit, but it's really hard to understand what the overall consensus of what the Iraqi people think of us being there. I mean, that wasn't our job really to think too much about that, even though we were there to also win hearts and minds, but our job was more locate, capture, and kill all anti-Iraqi forces and to stabilize the country to hand it over to the Iraqi people. That was our job, that was our mission, that's what we concentrated on. I didn't really put too much thought of what the Iraqi, you know, of course there's people that are thankful of you being there, but then also, you know, why are they shooting at you, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, the interpreters, you know, they tell you that, you know, God bless America, thank you for being here, but they're, you know, also working for you, you know, so it's really hard to understand or figure out, you know, what's going on there. I don't know. I'll probably be spending years and years thinking about that, but I don't know.
Camille?
Well, part of our job being intelligence, whenever we'd have, we've always brought the villagers from right around our base onto the, you know, onto the LSA there, and that was our whole job, was talking to them and see how they felt and trying to get, you know, up-to-date information on intelligence right around there. And what I got from most of the people that I talked to is all of them were very grateful that we were there, and that was all they kept saying is thank you so much for, you know, coming to help us. And other people, they really wanted to help. If they knew about some type of insurgent in the local village there, they really wanted to tell you. Most of the time they were just scared or were getting paid off. Being in intelligence too, you understand that most of the insurgents are called insurgents for a reason, because they're coming in from other countries, not necessarily Iraq. They're coming in from Syria and Iran and everywhere else. So most of the terrorists there in Iraq aren't really even Iraqis. So I mean, the Iraqi people that we got to talk to were very grateful, though, that we were there, and that, you know, helped our morale, too, as well, talking to them.
Brett?
Most of the contact I've had with Iraqis has been a handful of public and a lot of Iraqi National Guard and Iraqi police, the Iraqi army. And the biggest thing I can remember out of all of it is the bulk of the multinational forces over there, Iraqi police and Iraqi army, whenever we would be doing a mission or training or that sort of thing, I was around them quite a bit, is they were just amazed at how much America was willing to help them out. I mean, you're talking about a country that's been around and only known one way for several thousand years, and to have someone finally come in and give them hope and aspiration, you know, it definitely outweighs the random 10% insurgency that's out there. So you kind of woke up in the morning knowing that you were making a difference, but it's only one day at a time. That's the hardest thing for most people to grasp, is it takes time.
For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're talking with soldiers home from the front lines. I'm John Koopman of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm here with National Guard Sergeant Brett Miller, Army Sergeant Camille Evans, and Army Specialist Colby Buzel. Now we'll go to the audience for questions. Yes.
I'd like to know from Sergeant Evans, what's your impression of being a woman in the Army, and then also being in the having exposure to women in Iraq? We get a lot of different impressions here in the U.S., and just what your general take on it is.
When I first got there, I was at the aviation unit, and a lot of people always ask that question too, you know, do people treat you differently or expect differently of you because you're a woman? And our take on with my unit, what office I was in, I did work with all males, but I was there, but when we went to Iraq, I had been in the office and working with the unit the longest, so more people came to me and actually trusted me more. But there were some instances we worked with some infantry units that hadn't worked around females so much, and when I would go over there to give them their, you know, intelligence briefs, they kind of looked at me like, okay, we want to talk to your boss, we don't want to talk to you, sort of thing. The safety issue always came up too, and being over in Iraq, I always felt 100% safe around my fellow comrades. You know, they were our family, and we were there with them, and it helped, too, that I had a rifle and, you know, 210 rounds with me at all times. So you always feel safe that way. Coming into contact with the Iraqi women, we really weren't able to talk with the Iraqi women so much in their culture. They didn't want to – their women are more – you know, sheltered, they think more highly of them and don't want to expose them to us, so we never got to speak with any of the Iraqi women while we were there.
Next audience question, please.
Yeah, this is for Colby. I like, early in the presentation tonight, you were asked some of your general impressions, and you said that there were many things that were different from what you expected and you didn't know where to start. I'd like you to maybe give us two or three of those, two or three things. Here's what you expected and here's what you actually experienced. And also, if you could, I'm curious about your perspective, maybe between before and after, on the notion of serving. Camille seems to have a very strong notion of serving in the nation that she's proud of and she feels very much part of. Brett, you sounded like you had some career motivation to get in the National Guard, but also appear to be proud of what you did. I'd like a little bit more on that, service versus getting something else out of your enlistment.
Like patriotism? Like, is that what you're talking about? Like people enlisting and joining?
I see a lot. I have a friend whose mother is very much involved in POW, ex-POW activities. And I get a lot of emails from her about how we need to honor the vet, what the vet has done for us. The vet has, you know, ensured our freedom. The vet has died for us. And my impression is that a large number of people truly believe, you know, this is service. This is not, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm not joining for myself or because I don't have too much better to do or, you know, I'd rather do something else. It could be I'd rather do something else, but I feel like I need to do this. This is my patriotic duty.
Well, I joined, I had more of a job mentality about it, and I looked at it more as a job and also as a sense of adventure. You know, here we are, a country at war with another country. Here's my chance to actually go out and do something, you know, go out and experience combat deployment, you know. And I don't know who said this, but there's a quote, like, there is no adventure like the adventure of going to war, and I just wanted to experience that. You know, my father was a Vietnam veteran, did 20 years in the Army, and you know, and I have a lot of relatives that served, and so I didn't. I just, and my father always had like a, you know, that was his job. You know, he went, you know, mentality about being in the Army, and I don't know, I just kind of went into it like that. The other question was, you wanted me to elaborate more about experiences out there, like
what you expected versus what you experienced. You said there was
I expected at first you know, that it would be like I didn't expect as much boredom as what happened over there. You know, 90% of the time you're just sitting around so bored that throwing rocks is fun, and you'll do that for an hour, you know, and just throw rocks somewhere. You know, just the boredom, you know. A lot of times you're sitting around, and then a lot of times, you know, you're doing three or four missions a day, you know, for several days straight, getting a couple hours of sleep, you know, doing all sorts of stuff, you know, raids. I don't know. It's just different. I don't know. It's just different, man. I don't know. Sorry.
Thank you.
Next audience question, please.
Colby, you mentioned earlier that when you came back, you felt invisible to the rest of society and the rest of Americans. And I was wondering, for all of you, what do you think that people like us could do? Or what would you like to see? Or do you like to be invisible and just kind of blend back into your life?
Well, when I said, like, you know, you turn back to invisibility, it just doesn't feel like we're a country at war. You know, it feels like, you know, it's life goes on. It's, you know, I mean, here in America, you can go through life like not even knowing that there's a war on the other side of the country, not even caring, you know. I mean, you could just, it doesn't seem like there's a sense that, you know, that there's, you know, the only people that are called to sacrifice in this war seems to be the people in the military and their families and the people involved in that. And, you know, the rest of the world just kind of goes on. You look at other wars, either you're protesting for or against or involved in the war effort. In this war, it's just a small fraction of Americans that are called to sacrifice, and then you come back, and it's, I don't know. Maybe there's a sense of entitlement. Maybe there's you know, you want a handshake or something, but I don't know. You just come back, and I don't know. For me, you just felt like you know, life went on while you and, you know, all the other guys went off and did something. I don't know. It kind of messes with you, but that's what I meant by it, I think.
I felt the same way when I first got back. You know, you came back and I went back home to Texas and was talking to my friends, and they just had no clue about what was going on. And like you said, they felt like there was not even a war going on over there. And you do feel like almost, like you said, invisible when you get back. It's like kind of like we didn't do anything type thing. Like it wasn't, you know, it was worth our time. We felt like it was worth our time being there. But sometimes when you get back, you do feel like talking to people because they don't know. They're just like, oh, okay, I guess that is true. But the only other thing that, you know, y'all can do, like we said earlier, the morale was up for us while we were there, getting letters and care packages and stuff from people back in the U.S. And there are many websites you can go to. One of them is being that anysoldier.com. Soldiers over there actually go on there and request items that they need, different toiletries, more specific, and you can get on there and say, okay, I want to sponsor a female or a male soldier or, you know, some type of airman, and they'll actually, you can get in contact with people that way, ask them what they need, and then send it over there.
I haven't been home yet, so I really couldn't tell you about the invisibility thing. And actually, I've been kind of overwhelmed where I've been, being wounded vet from Iraq in the hospital. There's a lot of traffic that comes through there, you know, not to mention the media. You know, I had the honor this morning meeting the assistant commandant of the Marine Corps, a four-star general, shook my hand. And not a lot of people can say that they've been able to get that kind of support. So other than what Sergeant Evans was saying, I know that that was a big thing when I was over there. We were on missions all the time. And when you get a random package in the mail with just a whole bunch of goodies, that's a big boost.
Next audience question, please.
I've read several books written by folks who've been there and have come back. And the thing that struck me, the similarity that struck me, is that it seemed like they were there and then they're back. They're at war and now they're a civilian. I mean, the impression I got was that there was virtually no time to decompress, there was no time to debrief. And I'm wondering two things. Number one, is that accurate? And number two, is there perhaps another way of dealing with that situation of if it is accurate, you know, once you're on a battlefield one day and next day you're at a mall, and I would think that that would be somewhat a difficult transition to make. So my question is, number one, is that an accurate impression that I have? And number two is, should there be another way of dealing with that?
Well, I just got back this last October, and that was accurate. I got thrown, the day we got off the plane, we went back to like our regular work schedule, 9 to 5, and then I went home every night back to my house, and I didn't, like that he was talking about, he, Colby said he went and talked to the hospital there. I never got the chance to do that yet. Well, I guess a lot of my other people that came back with me did, but I think a lot of our views when we were coming back, we were just so excited to get back that I guess that whole lockdown period that you could talk about where we'd have our transitioning, most of us didn't want that. We were ready to get out there and go do stuff. Because I know like me and I guess like four other people while we were there all turned 21 in Iraq, so that was our first thoughts coming back is they can't lock us down. We got to get out. We got to go do stuff. So.
Yeah, when we got back to from Iraq, this was, maybe it's changed a lot. I heard they do decompress you a little bit. But when we came back, it was just, okay, you guys go have fun, go out and do whatever. And like six people got arrested, I think, that first night. I was one of them. The next formation, everyone, you know, guys with cuts all over their faces. You know, the day we got back, a bunch of soldiers went to a comedy club. You know, first day back from Iraq, and there was a comedian there, and he decided to make some jokes about soldiers and the war, and that ended up in a huge brawl. Like, they just stormed the stage and beat up the comedian. But I mean, it was a huge like fiasco. Like the first week back, like everyone was just getting arrested or and getting in trouble. But I think now they're wise to it. They know, you know, don't let them out and don't, you know, just keep them slow. I don't know, but hopefully.
I think the biggest thing for me going over there and having a weapon, going through combat maneuver situations all the time. As soon as I got back to the States, there's some things that you definitely felt naked without. A weapon was one of them. I think everyone, almost every soldier could tell you that. You get up and walk out the door, start looking around for a weapon, but there definitely is a transition that takes place. For some people, it doesn't take that long. For others, it'll probably take 4 or 5 years. You know, sitting with your back in the corner of a restaurant, you know, or cramming yourself in the corner of the elevator, making sure you got eyes on everyone, you know, hypervigilance. You start scanning buildings when you're walking downtown. You know, there's that level of hypervigilance from a lot of soldiers when they come back. I'm kind of blessed to be in a PTSD group that is very open over in Menlo Park, and it's a big help, big transition to step down off of that stuff.
Next audience question.
Hi, first I'd just like to say thank you. Thank you for serving your country. And my question. And my question initially was very much like the earlier questioner around support, so I'll focus in a bit more specifically, having a father who served in Vietnam and was drafted and who's now just getting VA support, what types of programs or infrastructure is available to soldiers that have returned, whether it be, you know, communities volunteering to support them that may need that type of transition support?
I think some of the most important decisions for that person to make is if they're ready for treatment. If a person isn't ready for any type of, whether it be psychological counseling, post-traumatic stress counseling, or even screening, it's not going to make the process flow very well. First of all, that person has to be ready and willing to go through that process because it's very exhaustive. It took me almost a week, several hours a day, before I could finally figure out what my traumatic brain injuries involved. The VA has stepped up quite a bit since my father's VA, and they're a lot more willing with open doors to take a veteran in and figure out what it is that's wrong. And the sky is the limit. It literally is. from anything from knee replacements to all the way up to major operations. So the main thing I'd have to say is a person has to be willing.
Colby, Camille, would you like to respond?
I think you pretty much summed it up.
Next audience question.
Hi, I read My War, Killing Time in Iraq, and when I was sitting there listening to your discussion on whether your equipment was effective or not, it occurred to me that there was this scene in your book where you were being attacked and you were in your tank and the ammunition was on the outside of the tank and you ran out of ammunition inside and you had to climb out and get the ammunition, but then you brought it back in and it was the wrong box. So you had to climb out again while you were being attacked and get the right box of ammunition. And I'm wondering, even if the equipment is new and there's lots of it, is it effective for you when you're fighting?
It was effective. I mean, I think it was the Striker Brigade's first deployment to Iraq, so we're still working through all the bugs and stuff. And I believe now we keep the hopefully they keep the ammunition inside the vehicle. But yeah, I mean, the ammunition was fine, the 50 cal. I mean, everything was fine except for the location of it. Hopefully they changed that. I know our platoon did immediately after that day, yeah.
Thank you.
Next audience question.
Hey, guys, I got a couple questions. The first concerning... who of you may have worked with Iraqi forces? I know, Brett, you said you did with Iraqi National Guard and police, and whether you, Camille, or you, Colby, worked with them at all, and just your impressions, how that went, whether you were able to establish any camaraderie with these guys and your sense of their readiness to actually, you know, take over any responsibility for the conflict, or at what point do you think we can begin handing it over? And my second question... Colby, you mentioned in passing the four questions you'd be asked in diagnosing PTSD. I was just wondering what those were.
I don't know them off the top of my head. I know if you look them up online, but I know it's four that they ask you to screen. And one of them's like, well, the first is, in the last month, have you, and then they ask you the four questions. One of them is have nightmares or been reminded of an incident in Iraq, and the other three, it's I don't remember for sure, but it was like, you know, have you been in a situation where your life was in danger in Iraq? Do you feel do you not like crowded situations or being in situations with other people? Are you paranoid? You know, questions along those lines. I think, like, at the end of the deployment, we had to take a PTSD test right before we deployed back to the States. And I think pretty much, like, everyone in our platoon, you know, tested positive for it before leaving. But it was, like, questions like, you know, have you been in a situation that you felt your life was in danger? Have you seen this and that? So it's... what was the other question?
About whether you'd worked at all with Iraqi forces and just your impression of the whole experience.
You know, when I was there, we did a lot of joint operations with the police and the Iraqi army. They seemed really enthusiastic working with us whenever we worked at them. But, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, if they want... You know, they've got to fight for it, you know? I mean, I've got the impression that, you know, they're not going to fight and put their lives on the line if the Americans are here to die for them. You know, why should they fight, you know? So they, and a lot of times, like, you know, I'd be reading these press releases and the Army reports saying that the Iraqi Army and the Iraqi police would be doing all the fighting, and the Striker Brigade was in support. But a lot of times it was the complete opposite. We were doing all the fighting, and they were nowhere to be seen until the very end. But then the next day, you read in the papers, you know, way different than what I saw and experienced over there. But it's nothing. Yeah, I mean, it's a catch-22. You know, we got to get out of there. And, well, they're not going to fight as long as we're there. And yeah, we they've got to start fighting kind of thing.
Britt, did you want to answer that as well?
The golden question. I had an opportunity to work around and with a lot of the Iraqi police, Iraqi army, not only operational side, but training side as well. They're very fast learners. They're being outfitted very well, equipment, weapons, vehicles, that sort of thing. And I think the more you give them the reins, the more aggressive they are in what they do. There was a lot of times on our specific missions that we would, you know, tell the Iraqi police or tell the Iraqi army, you know, hey, we're behind you. We're following you. You show us the way. And it worked out a lot of times. Sometimes it didn't work out that well, so we'd have to, you know, pull back and do a short after-action review and kind of fix some things. But in the big sense of things, you know, they are molding their own country, the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. That four-star general that I met this morning had said that tribal leaders, regular citizens, you know, of these cities over in Iraq are starting to hunt down and kill the insurgents that are living in their town. And they're not even Iraqi army or Iraqi police. So I think it's the trickle-down effect is way into cause. I think there's a lot of things that have been transpired over the last 4 years since we've been there. But you got to understand it took 4 years to get to this point. So you can't train a country's security force overnight.
I think we have time for one more question or two. Just for the record, I think our panelists will be around for after the program is over if you want to ask more questions of them at that point. Next audience question.
This is an example of the question I came up to ask. Is quite a different than the question I want to ask right now. Because Sergeant Miller, he just came to the ultimate question of how do we get out of Iraq? And I'd pose that to all the panel. You've had experience there. You've served in your own individual missions. What would be your call if you were in charge of the strategy of how to get out of Iraq and be able to preserve an integrated Iraq?
Well, if I was an armchair general, I would definitely say that we're going to be there for a while. I think if you were to just get up and walk away from something that you have more than 50% involvement in, there's going to be a lot of things that dropped loose ends. And the result of that, I think, would be catastrophic due to the influx of insurgents that, you know, are coming into that country. A lot of the people that we rolled up at traffic control points or, you know, RPG attacks, sniper attacks, weren't even from Iraq. So you have a large amount of people that are coming into Iraq that are not Iraqis that are hiding out. You know, it's a very hard situation. I mean, in all the previous countries that we've been at war with, we're still there. So it's gonna take time.
Let me follow up on that just a little bit. Is it the insurgents or is it the tribal issues?
The tribal issues is something that can be worked out between Iraqis and Iraqis. There may be cultural differences inside the country, but all Iraqis, from what I've seen where I was on the ground face-to-face, is they are tired of people messing up their neighborhoods, messing up their schools, and tired of being afraid. That's what I've seen when I was over there. And the big answer is, how long will it take for Iraq to be completely fed up with it and take it into their own hands? That's the big question.
Camille?
I kind of agree with both Brett and Colby on that one with what he said earlier. It's kind of one of those things, you can only teach them so much and we can only do so much for them before they're going to pick it up or not. And if we... I think our what I would do personally would, start handing it over to the Iraqi army slowly, but, surely it's going to be, a few more years, and then what probably is going to end up having to happen is kind of like the whole Korea thing, setting up some main base camps that are there, hard stations, like just, three or four that are going to be there pretty much for the next 20 years, because like Brett was saying, this is something that's going to take a lot of time. If it's not really developing that quickly, I don't see it as.
Colby?
I really can't even answer that. Like, what would I do? Like, I was just an E4 specialist, lower echelon soldier. Like, I don't even know how to answer that.
Well, Sergeant Evans just said 20 years. Is that a fair estimate from your standpoint?
20 years, like how long the war is going to go on for?
That how long we'd have to occupy that country.
Oh, we'll be occupying that place for a long time. Yeah, we've got bases there. We're dug in there. That place is going to be another South Korea. We're going to have bases there for a long time. We're not leaving there.
Well, the good part of it is we're gradually pulling out of South Korea nowadays. So there is light at the end of that tunnel. Thank you.
Next audience question.
Either Brett or Colby or both of you. Maybe just starting with you, Brett. What have been the major internal obstacles that you've had to face and deal with to get closer to a place of really dealing with some of the PTSD issues? What would you say are maybe two or three of the major things you had to face in order to feel more open and more ready?
I think the biggest thing that I've had to realize, my neuropsychologist in December, with my memory and everything else that's been going on, is basically, she summed it up in a short sentence of, you need to get over it. And move on. And part of my problem is I'm very self-critical, so I'm trying to fix things myself when I shouldn't be. The PTSD has been a thing of very unique for me since my memory's so poor that either I don't have dreams or I don't remember them. And there's a lot of things that are inside my head that I can't get out because of my head injury. So being around a group of other PTSD veterans in that format, in an open situation like this, where everyone brings up what their topics are, and that's kind of a cue, to where I can look at that and examine that on my own field and see if it's something that bothers me as much. It's pretty much self-reflection, I think, is the hardest thing for a person to do when they know that there's something wrong, but they don't quite have the tools to do it. And with a head injury, it's kind of hard to learn and memorize new tools. So it's kind of a catch-22. But I'd say being around others that are in the same shoes is probably the most beneficial thing that I've had to have the pleasure of being around. Some of those other vets over there in Menlo Park at the PTSD Center are truly exemplary men and women. Some of the things that are said in that room are truly has no bounds emotionally, and those are the things that are hard to chip away if you don't have a group like that.
Colby, I was struck by a couple things you said. One was that a lot of people assume that when a soldier comes back, he's going to have problems, when you felt pretty much fine, and yet you mentioned that you when you took that test, you checked all the four boxes. And then the other thing I noticed was when you said, you're going to be thinking about this for a long, long time. And I was just wondering, what are you going to be thinking about?
Well, the Iraq War is pretty much blocked out of my head. That's my way of dealing with coming back. I mean, a lot of the soldiers that do have problems, they never close that chapter of their life. You know, mm-hmm. they've left it open. They've constantly thinking about it. They're the guy, the drunk guy at the corner of the bar telling war stories to strangers. You know, they're the guy that, you know, that never got over coming back. You know, they're still there.
Right.
You know, and like one of my friends who sees help down at the VA hospital in San Diego, his counselor tells him, you know, what you got to do is close the chapter. That part in Iraq is over and move on. Just you weren't there. Just move on. And that part of your life is over and start a new life and move on. And I guess subconsciously, like I tried not to really pay attention to the news. I try not to, you know, when people, strangers ask me, you know, or friends, you know, where have you been the last couple of years? I won't even tell them I joined the Army or went to Iraq because I don't even want to talk about it. You know, I don't even want to hear them tell me, you know, this and that or talk, you know, it gets wearisome, you know, and it's like, it's, so I'm like at the point where it's like, I don't watch the news. I don't really follow, well, I do a little bit, no, I don't watch the news, but I read a little bit of it online. But, you know, I'm pretty much, like, you know, this has been a real challenge even coming over here and speaking to you guys because I got to remember that experience, you know, because I was there, but then my way of dealing is come back and just kind of block it out and go through life. I mean, it took me, I've been back for like 2 years, a little over 2 years. It took me about a year to get to that point where, like, you realize, you know what, no one cares, you know, block it out of your mind, move on. Took me about a year to deal with that. For years straight, I drank pretty much every night, you know, to deal with coming back. And now I'm just now recently starting to, you know, get on with things, you know. So, you know, it's a tough transition back, but everyone deals with it in their different ways. With me, I choose to just block it out of my head, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Well, I'd just like to say that I've had the pleasure of serving on a lot of panel discussions on the war. This is, I think, one of the best I've ever dealt with, and primarily it's because of these three. You know, we're not dealing with intellectuals or experts or people that officers or generals. You know, these three individuals. You know, you hear about the war in Iraq. Well, they were right there on the ground and seeing everything. So I'd like, let's give a hand to our panelists, Brett Miller, Camille Evans, and Colby Bazell. Now this meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, is adjourned.